Cavan Rowe is a very young and very handsome man. And I think Dr. Geeshan gave you a sense of the fact that he is an up-and-coming scholar. And it really was an honor and a privilege to read his paper. I think maybe one way to begin, as many panels do, is to ask if any of the panelists have a question of one another. So,
and then if anybody has questions.
And as they might begin a discussion of a question, please feel free to take your place at one of these microphones, where you are certainly welcome to ask us any question. Whether or not we will answer them is another thing. But anybody here have a question of one another? Okay. No? All right, let's take Mr. Petty, your question.
Rick Petty, Fredericktown, Missouri. Dr. Geeshan, I really appreciate your paper. And as I was listening to it, it made me think of, a generation or so ago, there was a lot of attempt to try to separate Paul from Jesus, that, you know, Paul was starting a totally different church in opposition to Jesus. You don't hear so much of that today. But as you were giving your presentation, it dawned on me that that could be an area that you could really show complete continuity and congruency between Jesus and Paul, apart from having to show that their whole doctrine of justification was one and the same. This is a completely different area that shows that, in fact, they're not in opposition to each other whatsoever. Yeah. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I team teach with Dr. David Scare, so I wanted to make sure that I was tracing some of the historical gospel tradition that's found, you know, in the epistles. Sometimes we overlook that, like Paul, who is writing at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 around the year 50, 51, writes about Christ coming as a thief in the night. And one might say, depending upon when we date the writing of the four gospels, this might be the actual earliest record of Jesus teaching, written, you know, record of Jesus teaching, that he will return like a thief in the night. You know, very interesting. But I do think that, you know, sometimes we overlook that because Paul is addressing oftentimes congregational problems and situations. He isn't always, you know, going back and recounting. He often summarizes very briefly Jesus' tradition, Jesus' life, Jesus' teaching. But it is an important area, and I think one that we need to take these little phrases and tease them out. What is Paul summarizing here? And oftentimes it's gospel tradition. Thank you.
Okay, I'm just going to go back and forth to the microphones. Yes, I'm here, Michael.
Pastor Mark Meyer, Emmaus Lutheran Church, Poisippi, Wisconsin. I enjoyed the closing comments on Dr. Just reading of Dr. Howe's
Rose.
Yeah. Stating Dr. Just had not gone political on us.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, we have no fear of being political.
Yeah.
Artemis is not great, and Allah is not God. And isn't there a lot of parallel that we need to address in regards to our political, religious being? Not much of a question.
I don't know if you noticed on that picture of Thessalonica that I took when I was there of Paul, that there was a minaret behind it. So I thought that was kind of a nice...
Just one comment, too. And I was saying this in the best sense of the word. You know, polis has to do with city. And Christianity was concerned about reaching out to people in cities. And sometimes we have almost gotten to that point where, you know, we've abandoned some cities. And that's, you know, not where early Christian mission was at. It was at going right at the heart of these poli, these cities, and being, in a sense, that which disrupted the life because it brought a different life, namely the life of Christ, into that polis, that pagan setting.
Okay, over here.
Pastor Ron Stevens, Fort Wayne, Zion. Dr. Geishan, I was wondering if you might comment a little more of St. Paul's explicit use of the personal name of Jesus in his eschatological statements in Thessalonians.
Yeah. It is, he just uses that first name alone in verse 9 of chapter 1. And I think, you know, we're so used to hearing when Paul writes, talking about the Lord Jesus or Jesus Christ, and that stark, just the use of the personal name. It's actually the French author, a famous commentary on 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, one of the thickest, is purely in French, never translated. Rigaud wrote, he said, this is a great evidence of Paul's emphasis on not in any way being ascetic, not losing sight of the historical Jesus by just talking about the Christ of faith, but actually grounding the hope in the coming Christ in the flesh and blood earthly Jesus. So, you know, I think it's a good observation. Not that Paul is somehow leaving out lordship of Christ or messiahship of Christ by just using Jesus there, but really, you know, that stark, almost like saying Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah. So, just yes. A quick comment.
Good afternoon. Vicar Jim Prothro from Virginia. This is particularly for Dr. Geishan. You had talked about teasing out phrases.
I told you eschatology was interesting. So.
Anybody can comment on it. But one of the things that you had mentioned is potential pre-Pauline tradition with Honeste and the intransitive there.
Right.
Now, based on multiple attestation, I'd always thought that Agerthe would be the pre-Pauline tradition and that would be Paul's own wording. Could you comment more on that? You had mentioned it, and I didn't hear the significance teased
right.
out. I apologize.
I actually didn't give you much because I was, you know, pushing through rather quickly. But the point I wanted to make is Paul, in his own writing, usually uses egeiro, namely, Jesus was raised, i.e. by the Father. And so you have the passive voice used and a different verb. So some commentators, as they comment on 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, and the different use of the verb and also the active voice, just say, a possibility for that is that it is reflective of pre-Pauline tradition. And if you want to push this a little bit further, I mean, I mentioned very quickly, there's a whole monograph on it, I disagree with it, on the Logos Kyriou language, the word of the Lord. It's obviously, Paul is emphasizing a word of Jesus. The question that some have is whether it's from the earthly ministry tradition, namely the teaching of Jesus there, or whether it's from some kind of exalted Jesus revelation. But, you know, I think that there's more to be said for the former, and that's what I mentioned very briefly. So it could be, one might say, Paul is actually reflecting the tradition that he's received, and the unique verb as well as the voice reflects that. Because usually elsewhere when he writes of Jesus being raised by the Father. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
And the other part was just sort of in terms of making that decision. What about the other uses in other authors, like for, say, Luke and Acts, in all the speeches with Agerthe?
I'm still writing on that. Okay. I'm at 1 Thessalonians 3. So when I finish 1 Thessalonians 4, I'll you know, drop me an email. And I'll
yes, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, for Dr. Scare, our most recent agendas, at least, that I'm aware of, have used the choosing of the seven in Acts 6 as foundational for installing church officers in our congregations. Would you care to comment on the validity of that, using that text?
No, I think it's a great idea. You know, Luke is also a little loosey-goosey, so it's not like when you look at that, the whole diaconal thing, it's that Acts 6 is to me clearly establishment of what we call ministers, so the same term. At the same time, this word for service can also be used in when Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law, and she recovers, and then she serves diaconally. So in some sense, this kind of natural, there is a natural overlap, I think, between the service of what goes on by the ministers and then what the people also do. So I don't think we should be too uptight about those things. If you get the big vision down, it seems to me you could be more relaxed about some other things.
Anybody else? Okay, go ahead.
Dr. Jack Kilcrease, Aquinas College, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
It's working.
Yes, it's on. Okay. I want to thank you for reading Dr. Rowe's paper. And I think that it brings up a very important point about the witness to the church in terms of having a distinctive understanding of God's law. I guess what makes me nervous, and knowing some of the background within the Duke Divinity School, particularly with Stanley Hauerwas, is that it kind of suggests that what's really peculiar about the church is that it has a distinctive law. So the New Testament becomes more law, better law. I was particularly struck by his reading of Paul's defense. His reading of Paul's defense is that, well, Jesus displayed a life form of peace, so we won't revolt, rather than perhaps the promise that, well, Jesus has inherited the kingdoms of the world, so we don't need to revolt because we already possess all the kingdoms of the world. So I guess my difficulty here is that it seems like what's being read into the text maybe a little bit is Stanley Hauerwas, Yoder, Aristotelian virtue ethics. The church is a peculiar community that enforces the law and then forms people into particular activities, and they develop certain virtues, and less the church is the place where we are collectively passive and receive the gospel. So if you could maybe address that.
We have two Acts scholars.
And we have somebody who studied with Stanley Hauerwas, do we not? This is your last symposia as a president, Dean.
Well, in a word, I'd share your concerns about Stanley Hauerwas and the kinds of moves he makes relative to that scriptural text, and he's very influential in Duke. So I think your caution is in order. I really, it was a treat to study with him in one respect, because we would read a book a week, and then be subjected to his hyperboles and rhetoric, which were quite vigorous if he didn't like your conclusions. Interestingly enough, to me, one sadness there is how, according to the last things I've read, he has abandoned some key elements of the scriptures in terms of ethical response to issues such as homosexuality, and finds room for that practice to go on in the church. It's a disappointing development.
You know, he did that. It's a commentary on Matthew, didn't he? One of those.
Yeah.
And when I've read it and used it, and I mean, his whole accent on just peace, and he's a kind of a pacifist, comes out in that commentary. I think what sort of, a direction I would have gone, or at least accented that Rowe didn't, is the fact that the kingdom is at a table, and that when people say, where's the kingdom, it's where Jesus is, and there is a sense of the kind of the stark confession of the church, that you have Rome, but you have gathered together, you know, around a scroll and a little bread and wine in a house church, you have the kingdom of God. And that, in many ways, that's not revolutionary and it is. You know, so there's something there that is even beyond anybody in the empire's comprehension of, I mean, and talk about an eschatology that kind of blows people's minds. And that was sort of, I mean, I would have, if he were here, I would have liked to have pursued something like that with him.
You know, if I could tack on a comment to Dr. Just's analysis here is, if you look at how Hellenism spread and Alexander recommended the Greek vision, it was really very astute. They would put the gymnasium with theological festivals, that is, athletics. The agora, the marketplace, had all those kind of accruements of theology. And then the amphitheaters. So your entertainment industry, your sports industry, and your commercial industry were embedded in Greek theology and the sacrifices associated. And I think it's a remarkable thing to think how the altar of Christians, the table, deconstructed all of that and turned the world upside down with the Eucharist and the voice of Jesus. It's a beautiful kind of commentary on how the means of grace, God's presence, can undo a civilization. And if you look at the culture we inhabit, how many people's self-understanding isn't formed by precisely, you know, the shopping mall, the great games of sports, and then entertainment? It's still, and the church, in my view, needs to invade that territory with the altar, the font, and not simply an abstract word, but the real presence of Christ.
Maybe just to add one point to this, too, is the whole aspect that did not get a lot of emphasis in his book is worship. And I think of it this way. You know, not only is the Christian a witness in who he is stopping and who he's not worshiping, namely withdrawing from the pagan temples and the like, but most importantly then, who is he worshiping? Who is he? And so, you know, that whole aspect that one might say is the gospel focus of receiving the benefits of Christ in baptism and in word and in the Lord's Supper, you know, isn't a big focus of that particular volume. Yeah.
Pastor Brege?
Dr. Daniel Brege, St. Paul, Decatur. Again, about Dr. Rowe's paper, which seems to be getting all the questions, and he's not even here. Do you think the juxtaposition that he talked about, the yes and the no, which was realized by example in Acts, is really fleshed out theologically in Romans, especially Romans 13? I guess, you know, what I'm thinking, there Paul says, look, the government, and he's talking about the Roman government, this is an arm of God. We're not against it. And yet Christ is Lord. You know, there is that yes and no, that juxtaposition.
Yes.
Thank
yes.
you. it was good after the previous question to have a quick one.
Yes. My name is Hisham. I pastor an Arabic church in Chicagoland. It's the first Arabic church out of converts in Chicago. We planted the church 3 years ago. I apologize because I want to comment on a comment, really. It reminded me of a painful story that I was invited with another LCMS pastor a few years ago to do a presentation in northern part of Michigan. And after a few weeks, we received an email canceling the invitation because my friend signed under his name God is love in Arabic, writing Allah Mahabba. And my fellow pastor was Bernie Lotz, Reverend Dr. Bernie Lotz, so an old LCMS pastor, graduate of Fort Wayne. So the pastor sent an apology saying his elders say that Allah is not God and they are against our presentation. So I just want to remind each other that in the 19th century, the first Arabic translation of the Bible by a Presbyterian missionary called Van Dyke and a Christian Lebanese. They replaced Yahweh with Allah, you see, and for a century the Arab Christians used the word Allah, meaning the triune God, to worship, and we at Salam Arabic Church use it. I prefer Rab, which is Lord, but it's still kind of used in Arabic. And the Pakistanis found, and the Iranians, a different version, Khudai, which I encourage, but I mean, we have half of the fellowship is Iranian. So I think we should approach Islam with love, not with hate. It's an opportunity, you know. The presence of Muslims again, among us in the West is an opportunity to share the gospel with them with freedom, without taking a bullet, you know. We may take a bullet here, but I mean, there it's for sure, here it may be, you know. I just also want to comment that maybe the mosque was Hagia Sophia behind Hagia Sophia, yes, in Turkey, right? So the mosque was a church. And I drive around in Chicagoland, I see really, I found three churches that were turned into a mosque. And the approach towards the culture in your presentation about Artemis is what Muslim activists are doing in the West. They are trying to tame, quote-unquote, the Western culture into acceptance of the Muslim culture, which is really, they are doing what the early Christians did to the Roman, Greco-Roman culture. So this is, there is a threat, but we also have to approach the Muslim people with love in order to share the saving, the salvation, the gospel with them. Thank you.
Yes, we got a couple more maybe, and then we'll have to move on to our next presentation. Pastor Olson, yeah.
Tom Olson from Tryon, North Carolina. Thank you all. Dr. Scare, regarding your comments with regard to Peter, James, and John, and then Peter, John, and James in Luke, I always took that to be due to the death of James, and perhaps Luke was written soon thereafter, and the rise of John in some way or whatever. But your point that there was perhaps some strife, if not between Peter and John, perhaps between the followers of Peter and the followers of John, and that Luke shows the unity of these two, seems to be very important. And I wonder if it has, would that exist if the Gospel of John had not yet been written, do you suppose?
Would what exist?
That this need to show the unity,
yeah,
of Peter,
think,
and John.
Yeah, I think personally that the Gospel of John existed in some sense earlier, and here I just one of my colleagues believes that John 21 was originally part of the gospel. I think it was added later, and I think the tension between Peter and John you find in the gospel, and where he kind of makes up for it. It's a fascinating story. I don't know. I haven't seen anybody who's caught on to this, but if you look at John chapter 21, which is kind of the makeup chapter, and it's halfway, whether it's makeup or not. Because Peter is an ambiguous situation. Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me? And as Dr. Justice noted, he doesn't agape him, but he will phileo him. But the fascinating thing, when you want to see what the division is, look at John chapter 21, where they actually name the apostles there. They include Nathaniel, Thomas, I forget who. They're all the ones who, by the way, make great confessions in the Gospel of John. You'll note in the synoptics, it's Peter, so we saw today, who was the one who confesses that Christ is the Son of the living God, or at least the Christ. In the Gospel of John, Peter's confession is not included, but Nathaniel gets it right away. You know, others get it, and Thomas gets the best confession. Son of the living God is fine, but can you beat my Lord and my God is the best of all by Thomas. And at the end of the gospel, it says, you know, as in the makeup section, it says, Peter says, I'm going to go fishing. And that's not just a story, like in the Luke's story is not about fishing in Luke 5. And John 21 is not about fishing, but it's about the apostolic ministry in which, again, they will be casting nets. And Peter says, I'm going to go fishing. And that's not simply saying, I'm bored, I don't know what to do. In some ways, he's longing to do that which he was first called to do. And it says, the names of the apostles, and I believe they were John's clique. Again, they always say there's a dispute at the Lord's Supper about who's the greatest. It's never about five people saying they're the greatest. Every group is divided into two. And John sensed his importance. And Peter says, I'm going to go fishing. And then they name the others, and then they say, we'll go with you. And I think that's a way of saying, whatever happens here, and Peter's leadership is ambiguous, they are at that point agreeing that the church will be one, and they're going to go with Peter into the next. And I think it humanizes, whatever divisions we have now, and there are always going to be divisions, the Gospels are not afraid to show the divisions then, too, on any number of levels. And, I mean, to me, I find that comforting, but it's also, it's the way the Gospels present it themselves, so.
Yes.
Gerhard Mundinger. This is for Dr. Wenthe and others, but if you could flesh out a little bit more this tension between democracy and Torah, because it seems to be a persistent and continuing struggle even within our own synod, and particularly since the Enlightenment, about who has the authority in the pastoral office. On the one hand, we have Korah's rebellion. On the other hand, we have 2 Timothy talking about rightfully preaching the truth. We have after the Barman Declaration, we have Bonhoeffer going off and starting his own seminary, De Novo. We have the loss of Stefan with the bishop and the struggle that Walther went through in terms of the establishment of the church in our country. And we got John Chrysostom in the 3rd century, about the gates of, or the pavement of hell with the bones of bad preachers. How do we balance all of this? And we have within districts, we have struggles over bad preachers who, or at least thought to be bad preachers, and yet we've got preachers who are thought to be bad who really are quite faithful to the gospel, but they, the gospel is always offensive and their congregations don't like what they're saying. This is a continual ongoing struggle.
In 2 minutes, Dean.
Okay. Well, I think you've put the question nicely, and I think it's an even now and a not yet. That is, even now we have embodiment of the Torah in faithful pastors and in faithful laity. What I was trying to kind of surface was that I think in recent years, and this may be a part of my bias as a seminary person, is I've thought that the pastors are being subjected to critique that is not really geared to or flows from the Torah. To give you an example, I think lots of our grads robustly support the church's historic, the great traditions, deep commitment to Christian marriage. And where marriages have been troubled, they try to hold them together. And even where there's a scripturally justified reason for divorce, they work for healing. But now, increasingly, they inhabit a culture in the suburbs where that is considered to be an inappropriate position, that it's simply common for marriages to dissolve, and people want to remain in good standing in the church. So I think at the core is the continual need to say there is a voice that trumps all other voices, whether it's the clergy or it's the laity, and that's the voice of Jesus. And when that becomes ambiguous because of the debate, I think there we need and benefit from the great tradition. For example, one of my classmates who's gone the way of the left was complaining about the parochial character of John Paul II. And my colleague grew up in a suburb in Florida, spoke one language, and thought that women's ordination was the greatest thing since creation. And I said, well, you know, you may differ with the Pope on many things, but he's not as parochial as you are. He speaks 33 languages, and you know, and he's lived under communism. And if you read the Splendor of Truth, he believes in a very classic rendering of Christian epistemology. And I think that's where we could benefit from a much more rigorous engagement of the great tradition, and to say we, with Luther, affirm the great creeds and the great positions of the Church. And I'm grateful that, you know, the president of our church has come out already, pro-life, pro-marriage. And what I resist and what I wanted to try to serve is to let this kind of decision be made in the circles of power, where our culture is marionated, as one pastor said. You know, we're taught to think that the vote, that the will of the majority is in fact God's will. And in that case, I think we are called to, as particularly as pastors in the ordination vows, to stand in so far as God gives us strength for the healing voice of Jesus. One other analogy, I was on the Roman Catholic, Lutheran Catholic dialogues in the last triennium, and one of it, we had 10 Roman Catholic priests, 8 Elka theologians, and 2 Missourians. And the one Elka theologian could not stand Missourians. He just, so every opportunity he got me aside. And the one time he was especially vigorous in saying I was a homophobic misogynist and some other lovely adjectives. And I said, you know, good brother, I think, you know, we're the church that really loves the homosexual or other parts of our culture that are needing the gospel, because by endorsing a behavior that our Lord says is harmful is to catapult that harm with the church's blessing. If you come to an adulterer and say, this is not the healing voice of Jesus that has led you to that, it's the same with other immoral behavior. And to that he said, you know, you should have lived in the medieval period. And you know, I think what it really showed was a contrast between the great heritage of the church, its understanding of human beings, what we are as God's in flesh creatures, versus a rather fresh and novel understanding that has a veneer of Christian language, but at its core is light years apart from the healing voice of Jesus. So,
thank you. I'll share with you my picture, my personal picture of John Paul II.
Okay, good. Okay.
There are two at the microphone, but unfortunately, I think we need to move forward to Dr. Nordling. But please feel free, the two of you, to ask any of the panelists your question later in private. We'd be happy to take those. Thank you. Please don't go anywhere. Our next speaker is about ready to speak. So thank you, panel. Thanks, Dina.